From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a woman's perspective on life in the mob. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Teresa Carpenter, author of Mob Girl, the story of a woman who is the daughter of a racketeer, was a mistress to many wise guys, ran a bookmaking operation, and became an informant. Also today, we examine the advisors to the presidential candidates and what special interest groups these advisors represent. It's the subject of a new report issued by the Center for Public Integrity. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, the TV spinoff from the hit adventure movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Yesterday's primary races were a preview of an even larger set of contests next week. 11 states hold primaries and caucuses with twice as many delegates at stake. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
No clear winner emerged among the Democrats yesterday, and President Bush failed to shake his Republican challenger, Patrick Buchanan. But the contest set the stage for Super Tuesday in just 1 week. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton's big victory in Georgia, according to political analysts, is a preview of what could happen in many of the states up for grabs next week. Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas, however, is expected to take Rhode Island and Massachusetts with ease. In the Republican races ahead, Buchanan will still be a factor, although the president is expected to beat him handily in every state, especially in the South Carolina primary on Saturday. And without a competitive showing in the conservative South, Buchanan will have a difficult time making the case in the races ahead that he is the conservative Republican challenger. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey returned to Washington today to reconsider his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. Kerrey did poorly in yesterday's round of primaries and caucuses, finishing no higher than fourth. He said he'll make an announcement tomorrow. CBS News is quoting sources who say that Kerry will withdraw from the race and aim for a spot as the running mate of the eventual Democratic nominee. The winners in yesterday's contest have fanned out to campaign for the next round. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton was in Florida today, but says he'll be in Dallas tomorrow for a debate with other candidates. Former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas toured a steel plant in South Carolina, and former California Governor Jerry Brown joined a picket line at a hotel in Las Vegas. Israeli security authorities have arrested four men accused of killing three Israeli army recruits more than 2 weeks ago. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
All four suspects are Israeli Arabs, citizens of Israel from villages in the north. Police said they're activists in the most extreme Muslim fundamentalist group, the Islamic Jihad. Security sources said they believe the group organized locally and did not receive help from outside Israel. Local Islamic leader Sheikh Abdullah Nimr Darwish condemned the killing of the three Israelis and said all violence should stop. But the arrests increased the tensions between Arab and Jewish citizens of Israel. The Israeli police chief called on Jewish citizens to remember that the vast majority of Israeli Arabs are law-abiding. Arab villagers also held meetings with Jewish neighbors to try to defuse the tensions. Police said more arrests are expected in the case. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices were down sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,268.56. Declines led advances by a margin of about 10 to 6 in heavy trading. This is NPR. More than 100 miners died today in an explosion in northern Turkey, and hopes are fading for the survival of 150 others who are missing deep underground. The explosion, apparently caused by methane gas, occurred more than 1,800 feet below the surface. Workers cut off ventilation shafts to prevent air from feeding the fire. Turkey's biggest labor confederation charged that the accident was a result of low safety standards in the mines. The European Commission today formally proposed the EC discontinue use of ozone-destroying chemicals by the end of 1995. Recent studies suggest a dramatic thinning of the ozone layer over Europe is possible by as early as this spring. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The ozone layer filters out some of the sun's harmful ultraviolet rays. Its depletion could lead to more cases of skin cancer and eye cataracts and suppression of the immune system. New evidence of rapid thinning of the ozone layer in the northern hemisphere has prompted politicians to action. Recently, President Bush announced the United States would phase out ozone-destroying chemicals by 1996. Today's proposal from the European Commission to ban CFCs and other ozone-depleting substances by 1995 moves up the EC's target phase-out date by 18 months. The proposal is expected to be endorsed later this month during a meeting of the environment ministers from the EC's member states. I'm John Idstey in London.
The chairman of Delta Airlines announced today that he's looking for ways to cut costs, a prospect that's likely to make aircraft manufacturers nervous. Delta's Ronald Allen told the Associated Press that he wasn't ruling out the possibility that Delta may delay the delivery of new planes that it's ordered from aircraft makers. American and United Airlines recently did the same thing, backing out of expected deliveries of millions of dollars worth of new planes over the next several years. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Recent books by and about wise guys turned informants have given us inside views into organized crime. The new book, Mob Girl, tells about one woman's life in the underworld. Mob Girl is the story of Arlene Brickman. She was connected to the mob by blood, her father was a racketeer, by sex, her many lovers were wise guys, and by her work, she ran a bookmaking operation. In the mid-70s, for reasons of fear, revenge, and power, she became an informant for the police and the FBI. In 1988, at the age of 54, Brickman started looking for a writer to tell her story in a book. She chose my guest, Teresa Carpenter, a former crime reporter for The Village Voice. Carpenter's investigation into the murder of Playboy playmate Dorothy Stratton won a Pulitzer Prize and was adapted into the film Star 80. When agreeing to work with Brickman, Teresa Carpenter made it clear she would function as a journalist, not a ghostwriter. Reading Carpenter's book, you reach the conclusion that the way for a woman to have power in the mob is to have sex with men in the mob.
The way for a woman to gain power in the underworld is to do favors for wise guys, to do favors for bosses, crew chiefs, and among those favors, of course, is sex. There are other favors they do, primarily running errands, serving as couriers for hot gyms, for drugs. And Arlene performed all manner of favors, but among them, of course, there was a great deal of sex.
Was she sexually attracted to dangerous men?
Oh, yes, primarily to dangerous men. As you know, she grew up New York's Lower East Side among Jewish racketeers. Her father was a racketeer. Her grandmother was extremely interesting and flamboyant character who ran a funeral parlor, which was also a hangout for gang of called the Clinton Street Boys. But Arlene never found the Jewish mob she grew up in as dangerous and hence as erotically appealing as the Italian wise guys who were just a block over. And so when she reached her late teen years, actually in her early teen years, she developed a passion for the Italian hoods that lasted for a good 20 years.
Mob girl is a word that Arlene Brickman used to use to describe herself when she was talking to you. What did she mean by that expression?
Well, her own definition of a mob girl, she differentiated among types of mob girls. She said, there are mob girls who hang out with one guy and they're connected to a crew. There are mob girls who go from man to man, wise guy to wise guy, receiving along the way gifts and presents and nice dinners. And then at the apex of this hierarchy of mob girls was, of course, Virginia Hill, who was Arlene's idol. And she was, in Arlene's own words, a broad who really made it good.
So where did Arlene fit in these different categories of mob girl?
Well, Arlene certainly enjoyed a more distinguished career than the throng of anonymous mob girl who goes from man to man and then is eventually a burnout because of drugs or disease or whatever. Arlene seemed to be more purposeful in her selection of men. It's strange to use the term career-oriented when you're talking about someone in this lifestyle, but, you know, she was very proud of sleeping with name wise guys, Tony Mira among them, Joe Colombo. I mean, this later on when she turned informant and went to work for the government, she would reel off the names of the men she'd slept with as more or less a resume, which it was in both the underworld and in the world of law enforcement.
You describe how she lost her virginity when she was 12, and she didn't much like the sex, but she loved the attention. Do you think that that helped lead her into the life that she chose?
Yes, I think Arlene recognized early on that sex was a commodity. It was a means of gaining access to power. I don't believe she ever enjoyed sex that much. She certainly had plenty of it. But she knew that she could use sex to control, that she could use sex to get attention, she could use sex to get favors, and she used it liberally.
And also sex was used against her sometimes as punishment. For instance, she walked in on a hit when she was young, and her punishment or her blackmail was that she had to have sex with the hitman and with his friends. Otherwise, they might have hurt her so that she wouldn't squeal on them. But, you know, this is what she had to do instead.
Yes, I think that was a moment of revelation for her. She was quite young when this happened, in her late teens. And to that point, she'd been sexually active for 2 or 3 years, but she had always been under the impression that she was the one in control. And in fact, she realized then that she wasn't in control, that these men were holding all the high cards. And it precipitated a breakdown where she became depressed and had actually been taken to a therapist by her parents, who didn't know what was happening until the therapist managed to get it out of her.
I realize this might sound like we're trying to get pretty lurid about her sex life, but I find it a really very interesting demonstration of how men held women in check, and the one power that she seemed to have as a woman within this group was sexual.
Exactly. That, again, an ability to serve as a courier for messages, and you know, she served as a confidant as well, but I think, you know, a mob girl's chief function is to look good, to be a showpiece in a gangster's arm, and essentially to service him sexually.
Yeah, so it's a pretty good illustration of a very, very sexist world.
Oh, that's putting it mildly.
Well, I think Arlene Brickman's greatest moment of betrayal was when she was gang-raped by men who she thought were her buddies. She thought they were all on the same team, and she realized they weren't.
Yes. One thing that Arlene craved ever since she was a teenager was to be included in her father's circle, or in the circle of the Italian wise guy she hung out with. She really wanted to be one of the boys, to have the kind of respect that the men showed one another. And she had deluded herself into believing that through doing these favors, sexual and otherwise, that she was held in respect, that they felt genuine affection for her, that if she was in trouble, they would come to her defense. But one night, she got into trouble at a bar in Midtown, found herself trapped in a basement and was brutally raped by three wise guys. The rape itself, of course, was traumatic, but what followed was for Arlene, I think, the most traumatic experience of her career in the underworld. She called on every powerful wise guy she knew, including the late Tony Mira and Funzi Mosca, to come to her defense and to punish those who had assaulted her, and they did nothing. And they professed to be sorry about what had happened. They said they would look into it, and then nothing happened. And I think at that point she realized the lowly status that she really held in this society of mob figures.
So how did that change where she saw her place in the mob?
Well, I think in the book I described it as the end of innocence, and I think if there's anything that predisposed her toward turning informant in later years, and that occurred a few years down the road, it was that moment, the moment of the rape or the subsequent realization that she wasn't one of the boys.
She wanted to be a businesswoman in the mob as well. How far did she get in that?
Well, she was running a fairly successful bookmaking operation, first in Queens and then in Fort Lee, New Jersey. She was, that was actually her first and last arrest. She was busted, and that more or less brought her action to a close. But, she was supervising a number of runners, and, she had some business acumen. There's no question about it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Teresa Carpenter. She's a journalist whose new book is the true story of Arlene Brickman. The book is called Mob Girl, and it's the true story of a woman who was in the mob and then became an informant on the mob. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Teresa Carpenter is my guest, and we're talking about her new book, Mob Girl, A Woman's Life in the Underworld. How did Arlene Brickman become an informant on the mob?
Well, it began after the arrest. She fell into a strange kind of friendship with her arresting officers in Fort Lee, and they saw that she had rather extensive ties with New York crime families, among them the Genovese. And they cultivated her little by little. You know, they would call her, she would call them, just to talk, nothing serious. Simultaneously, she found herself getting deeper and deeper in debt with loan sharks. And at one point, the loan sharks threatened her daughter, Leslie, the daughter by the marriage to Brickman. The girl was then in her early teens, and that was really the catalyst, the turning point. She went to the two policemen who had originally arrested her and said that she would be willing to cooperate if they would get the loan sharks off her back and protect her daughter.
When she decided to cooperate and become an informant, what was her technique for getting information?
She was very brazen. In fact, every police officer who worked with her, every federal agent I talked to was astounded by her audacity. She was not at all shy. You know, she wore wires for the government starting in Fort Lee. In fact, starting with the case in which she originally went to the Fort Lee police. They then went to the FBI, and they wired her up to talk to these guys. And she was impressively courageous. One thing I learned in talking to law enforcement is that when they wire an informant, or even when they send one of their own men or women in, the thing they want that operative to do is to press, to pursue, to ask the second or third question. And often they can't get them to do that because that's very dangerous. If you appear too inquisitive, you are literally putting your life in danger. Arlene seemed utterly oblivious to the danger she was in. She would press, she would probe, she would ask the second, third, fourth question. And of course, the federal agents and the strike force prosecutor who was working with her were delighted when they saw the transcripts or they listened to the tapes, because this is just the sort of specificity that they needed to make the case against these fellows. So as an operative, she was extremely successful.
She wore a wire for about 10 years, right?
Off and on, yes, for
that's
a number
really
of agencies.
Long time.
Quite a while. And one of the questions I had of both her and law enforcement was how could she continue working without being found out? I mean, it seems like the underworld would you know, gossip would travel pretty rapidly there, and you know, she would get a reputation as an informant. But it seems like I'm to this day not quite sure why Arlene gets away with all she gets away with. Part of it is her audacity. Part of it is that she appears ingenuous and dotty at times that you think she couldn't possibly be a threat. It's amazing. I mean, it's her bravado, I think, that keeps her safe.
Most mobsters who turn against their colleagues and inform end up in the Federal Witness Protection Program. She chose to not join the program, and she's just, you know, living in hiding without the protection that the feds can offer her. Why didn't she take them up on the offer to join the protection program?
Well, she was offered the program repeatedly and each time turned it down. The reason being that if you accept the protection of the federal marshals, you have to live a fairly restrictive lifestyle. And for one thing, you can't commit crimes. You have to take the job that they arrange for you. You have to live where they set you up. You can't have any contact with your former associates or family. And until recently, Arlene's mother was living, and she couldn't imagine a world in which she couldn't call her mother 4 or 5 times a day. I think she just realized she couldn't live under those strictures and chose to protect herself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Teresa Carpenter, and we're talking about her new book, Mob Girl, A Woman's Life in the Underworld. Since Arlene Brickman was a con woman and you wanted to check out everything that she told you, what was it like fact-checking her stories? You had to go to the mob and ask them, is it true that you raped her? Or is it true that you sold drugs with her? I mean, how do you fact-check this stuff?
It's very difficult. Very difficult indeed. A number of the characters she was involved with had extensive criminal records. And, in the instances she wore wires, of course, there were public documents, transcripts of the wires that she wore, which bore out her story. I spoke with, the family maid who was, of course, loyal to Arlene, but she nonetheless confirmed to my satisfaction a number of the things that occurred in Arlene's early life. Talked with Arlene's mother and daughter, both of whom died during the course of my research. But I found Arlene's account of events to be extremely accurate. And I think it was because this book meant a lot to her. This was not just another con. You know, she was approaching her middle 50s at the time she decided to do it. I mean, she saw it more or less as the final chronicle of her life, something that would vindicate her life. And so she made it a point to be candid, extremely candid.
In your introduction to Mob Girl, you write that because manipulation was Arlene Brickman's art, that you knew that she was trying to manipulate you. How did she try to manipulate you, and were you able to get, how did you get beyond that?
Well, I knew that she was presenting a side of herself to me that she didn't present, for instance, to her mobster friends or the government. I mean, Arlene is very shrewd in reading expectations. You know, when she goes into a room, she sits down to answer questions. She'll try to see exactly what it is that you want from her in terms of a personality. And I think when she met me, she figured the tough girl persona wasn't going to play. And so she assumed the pose. I won't even say it's a pose because it's a legitimate part of her personality, but the aspect of Yenta, I mean, the kind of doting Jewish mother. And that's more or less the pattern that we fell into over the years that I did this book. I mean, there were other Arlenes I saw during that time. There was the demure little Arlene, which I imagine played very well when she was younger and an active mob girl. You know, there was the provocative, even abusive Arlene. But for the most part, it was the Yenta.
Do you think that the mob will ever be changed by feminism? It's one part of our society that has seemed to be resistant to it and immune to it so far.
I would say not. I mean, the mob itself seems to be taking some serious hits, and there's a question as to whether organized crime, as we now know it, will even survive. But I don't know that the mob would be reformed or even be made better by being feminized. That would, in fact, never happen. I mean, it is just such an unremittingly male and abusive male bastion that simply could never happen.
What did you find most revelatory in all the research you did for your book?
Well, you know, I was disabused of certain romantic notions about the mob. As I mentioned earlier, most of what we get, certainly most of the information I got, was from popular media, movies, books. You know, I very much enjoyed the Godfather trilogy. I certainly enjoyed Bugsy. I thought Goodfellas was wonderful movie making. But basically, these are fairy tales. They present the mob. The violence would tend to lead you to believe that it's a gritty, accurate portrayal of a lifestyle. But in fact, the underlying premise of those films in particular is that, you know, no matter how violent they are with one another, they're still men of honor. That simply is not the case. I mean, these are vain, callow, often homicidal narcissists. I mean, Bugsy Siegel and Virginia Hill alone. I mean, if you take those two, Bugsy was a homicidal sociopath, and Virginia was a glorified call girl. But we prefer somehow to think of them as these romantic figures. And going back to your original question, you know, the most revelatory thing to me was to see how crudely and crassly opportunistic people in this world are. You know, and Arlene is certainly one of those people.
How do you think Arlene Brookman would have told her story differently from the way you told it?
I think it would have come across more as we saw Virginia Hill in the movie Bugsy. You know, the fact of the matter is there were glamorous aspects to the life. You know, Arlene got jewels. She received furs. She enjoyed the company of powerful men. When she went in to a restaurant on their arm, they got the best tables. They were given preferential treatment everywhere they went. I mean, as long as they were in neighborhoods where those characters were recognized. You know, it was exhilarating, particularly for a young girl, to run with that crowd. I think Arlene sees her entire life through that kind of rosy filter of glamour. You know, I think that I had more perspective on her life, hearing the same facts that she was rendering to me. I mean, it on the surface, you know, is a glamorous life, but beneath it, it's very brutal.
Well, Teresa Carpenter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Teresa Carpenter is the author of Mob Girl, A Woman's Life in the Underworld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the presidential candidates and their campaign advisors. The Center for Public Integrity has issued a report on these campaign advisors, the special interest groups they represent, and the ethical questions raised for voters. Also, Indiana Jones is coming to TV. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a poor showing in yesterday's primaries and caucuses, Democratic presidential candidate Bob Kerry canceled today's schedule in Miami and flew back to Washington. This comes amid speculation that Kerry may announce tomorrow that he's getting out of the presidential contest. Kathy Lohr reports from Washington.
Senator Kerry has all but dropped out of the presidential race. While en route to Washington, Kerry told reporters he got up this morning, looked at all of the numbers from yesterday's elections, and made a decision.
It seems right to fly back to Washington and talk to people who have been involved in this thing from the beginning and have a discussion.
That discussion is with several of Kerry's fellow Democrats in the U.S. Senate. The Nebraska senator did not win any of the seven primaries and caucuses yesterday. In fact, he finished fourth or fifth in all contests. He was particularly disappointed about losing Colorado to Jerry Brown. Kerry plans to make an announcement about his campaign tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
Republican challenger Patrick Buchanan says that he has no plans to get out of the race for the presidential nomination, despite pressure from the White House. Campaigning today in the South in advance of Super Tuesday next week, Buchanan said they are going to have to battle for a long time now, and he called on the president to pull out of the presidential race. In yesterday's three GOP primaries, Buchanan took about a third of the vote. He has yet to win a primary. So far, President Bush has 148 GOP delegates, and Buchanan has 20. Algeria's main opposition party, the Fundamentalist Islamic Salvation Front, has been outlawed. The party was accused by the government of encouraging violence. As Alf Hermida reports, this court ruling in Algiers to ban the party had been expected.
After the military-backed government canceled elections to prevent the Islamic Salvation Front from coming to power, it seemed inevitable that the party would be banned. Algeria's rulers had waged a relentless campaign against the fundamentalist movement, arresting most of its leaders and thousands of its supporters. The decision by a court in Algiers to ban the Islamic Salvation Front comes as no surprise. The government had started proceedings to dissolve the party last month, following violent riots by fundamentalist demonstrators, which led to the declaration of a state of emergency. Though the party has now been outlawed, it will continue operating as an underground organization, with several of its leaders in hiding. They have warned that their supporters could resort to violence if the authorities persist in their efforts to destroy the fundamentalist movement. For National Public Radio, this is Alf Hamida in Tunis.
According to news reports in Moscow, the death toll from a two-train collision yesterday is now at 40. The crash west of Moscow involved an express train and a freight train. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 21 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Officials in Germany are calling on Moscow to send former East German leader Erich Honecker home if he is not seriously ill. Honecker is wanted on manslaughter charges in connection with shoot-to-kill orders against those trying to flee to the West. Honecker has now gone back to Chile's embassy in Moscow after spending more than a week in a hospital for tests. His attorneys have said that he is suffering from cancer, but according to government officials in Chile, doctors found his health totally satisfactory. A federal jury in Alexandria, Virginia, has convicted Dr. Cecil Jacobson of defrauding patients by artificially inseminating patients with his own sperm after telling them that they were getting sperm from anonymous donors. John Greenberg reports.
According to prosecutors, Jacobson may have fathered about 70 children in the Northern Virginia area. His former patients testified that he assured them that the sperm used to artificially inseminate them came from anonymous donors who matched the physical characteristics they requested. On the stand, Jacobson admitted that when a sperm donor missed an appointment, he had used his own. His attorney insisted that the practice was not illegal. Jacobson was also accused of tricking patients into thinking they were pregnant when, in fact, they were not. In all, Jacobson faced 52 counts of fraud and perjury. The jury found him guilty on all counts. Jacobson faces up to 280 years in prison and $500,000 in fines. Sentencing is scheduled for May 8th. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg reporting.
As expected, Israel has officially turned down a plan for Palestinian elections in the West Bank and in Gaza and East Jerusalem. The current round of Middle Eastern peace talks in Washington is now over, with no announced plans on when or where the next round of Middle Eastern peace talks will be held. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. With the primaries in full swing, we're all trying to learn as much as possible about the presidential candidates. My guest Charles Lewis says we can learn something about the candidates by examining who their advisors are and what special interest groups they represent. Lewis is the founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a Washington-based organization whose purpose is to bring a higher standard of integrity to the American political process. Lewis is also a former producer for the CBS program 60 Minutes. We invited Lewis to discuss the center's latest report, Under the Influence, Presidential Candidates and Their Campaign Advisors. Let's start with the advisors to the incumbent, George Bush. One of his press advisors is James Lake of the public relations and lobbying firm Robinson, Lake, Lehrer & Montgomery. Some of his firm's other clients include the Japan Auto Parts Industry Association, Mitsubishi, and Suzuki.
Back in a few months ago when Bush was in Japan with the auto industry executives, candidate Pat Buchanan in New Hampshire tried to make an issue of that, of Lake's representation of the Japan auto parts industry. So while Bush is on one hand talking about the need for competitiveness and for Japan to open up its markets, one of his advisors is working for the Japanese auto parts industry. So that has been reported, and that's sort of been out there. What we found that was different or that was new is that the Robinson Lake firm, which is the name of James Lake's firm, also represents the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority. And that entity basically is the owner of BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which is generally acknowledged probably to be the most corrupt bank in history. We felt at our news conference when we released this, and we say it in our study, that is pretty peculiar to say the least, that an aide to the President of the United States is on retainer to the owner of BCCI.
On the other hand, you could say that people who are most corrupt and most pure want to hire the best lobbyists or the best public relations expert or the best lawyers available, and it doesn't necessarily reflect on the politics of the person who's hired, you know, who their clients are.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, no, look, if you're at Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, there's probably no one in Washington you could hire who has more cachet with George Bush or the White House. I mean, from a strategic standpoint, it makes eminent good sense for them to hire James Lake and the Robinson Lake firm. But from the public interest standpoint, if the Bush administration or the Justice Department go easy on BCCI or on the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, I don't know their degree of culpability. They claim they are duped in the BCCI affair, and their precise role and culpability remains a little bit unclear here. If whatever government does in this regard, if there's someone who has been paid large sums of money, $200,000 for 3 months' work, just in fees alone, to basically, because of their access to the President of the United States, if that's how government is decided these days, then the public begins to think that if you can grease the skids and if money flows certain places, government loses its legitimacy, basically, and the public trust is eroded even further. So that's where I come down on it. There's no question in my mind why Lake was retained. His response about all this, of course, is kind of interesting. Lake says that there is absolutely no conflict of interest, that it is preposterous for anyone to suggest this. And the Bush campaign told CNN, for example, that Lake is working for a private corporation, the Bush Quayle reelection campaign, and is not subject to the Hatch Act or government ethics regulations that most government employees are subject to, which, frankly, is exactly our point. This is a person who has enormous access and very few controls on his activity.
So do you think it's unethical for the president to have as an aide someone who is also working for the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority?
Do you think?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that any entity that is in any way under a legal cloud right now, where there are federal prosecutorial authorities all over the nation looking at BCCI and all of its owners and shareholders and officials, as long as this mess is sitting there on the table, anyone being associated with it in any way and also having access to the President of the United States helping him with his campaign, it's a conflict of interest. And it looks very strange to the voter, I think, if when they hear about it.
Now, you also single out Bush's principal health care campaign advisor, Deborah Steelman,
right,
for being a registered lobbyist with Congress on behalf of Aetna Insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Missouri, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, and the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association.
Right.
What's the conflict there?
Well, health care is one of the principal issues in this country right now that people are talking about, have been talking about, and it seems to be building in terms of the public interest in this issue. The president has not issued a health care plan until a few weeks ago in the last year of his presidency in a reelection year. And his principal advisor is basically a lobbyist for hospital and drug company interests. So if you look at it and think about it in that context, and then you've got a person who's lobbying for those interests, is a registered lobbyist before Congress and paid, you know, substantial sums of money for those interests, and that is the president's principal advisor on health care, then what kind of plan is he going to offer, and how bold and how aggressive and how objective will it be to address the problem, or will it be a program that the industry itself is quite pleased with?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new study on presidential candidates and their campaign advisors. My guest is Charles Lewis, who's the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, which just released the report. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Lewis, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, which is a group dedicated to bringing higher standards of integrity to the political process, and they've just released a new report on presidential candidates and their campaign advisors. Let's look at some of the Democratic candidates. Why don't we start with a person who appears to be the front runner, Paul Tsongas. He just won the primaries in Maryland and Utah. Now, he was the only candidate who didn't cooperate with your study. He didn't release to your group the names of his advisors. Does that mean anything to you?
He released some of the advisors. He did not release all the names of his trade advisors. First of all, I don't even know if Tsongas knew that his staff didn't give out the names. We dealt with his staff on that issue. So I don't know what to make of it, but it's hard to draw any conclusions as a result, unfortunately.
So were you able to find out who his aides were, and were you able to reach any conclusions?
On his trade advisors, we weren't able to. On healthcare-type issues, we did notice some interesting advisors. We found that one of his advisors represents several hospitals and nursing homes and is a lobbyist on behalf of hospitals in the state government in Massachusetts. Another fellow advisor to him is a director and senior vice president of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. And a third fellow is a registered lobbyist in Washington before Congress, representing several health interests. And, of course, the Wall Street Journal has reported that Mr. Tsongas represented the American Insurance Association, which has among its members Aetna, Cigna, Travelers Insurance, and Hartford Life Insurance, which the Wall Street Journal said, quote, would benefit from Mr. Tsongas's health proposals, unquote.
Bill Clinton won his first presidential primary yesterday with in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about Bill Clinton, your report says that Clinton has stated we should rely less on imported oil and more on cheap and abundant natural gas from America.
Right.
And you point out that one of his advisors, Paul Landon, lobbies on behalf of the Natural Gas Supply Association. And also Skip Rutherford, one of his advisors, is a vice president of a Little Rock-based natural gas company.
Right. And there's a third person, Jack Stevens, who's a key fundraiser to Clinton, who is his family. The Stevens family has a 38% interest in something called the Worthen National Bank, which has extended a $2 million line of credit to Governor Clinton. I should go back to London for a moment. This fellow London has talked to us since the study came out, and he insists that he is a consultant, not a lobbyist for the Natural Gas Supply Association, and that he has not spoken with Clinton about natural gas. So I should make that clear. But the larger point is that Clinton comes from a state that has less than 1% of the country's natural gas, so there's no obvious reason for him to be really talking about it in terms of a constituency there. And he has several people around him. Whether or not they're specifically talking to him about natural gas, they certainly come from the natural gas industry. And I don't know, again, what all that means, but again, I think it's relevant for the voter to know it.
Let's move on to Jerry Brown. He just won the primary in Colorado. He has said that, you know, money is the corrupting force in politics. Is that consistent with the people who are advising him?
Well, it appears that it is, actually. We were kind of intrigued about this. Based on the list that we got from the Brown campaign, and I hasten to caution, which we put in our study, is we are a prisoner of the candidates in terms of what names they want to give us. As we mentioned earlier, Tsongas did not give all of his trade advisors to us. And so if there are other advisors we don't know about, that's life, you know, and so we go with what we have. But in the case of Jerry Brown, we found that, for example, on trade, he does not appear to have any quote-unquote foreign agents, you know, registered at the Justice Department working for overseas interests. In healthcare, he does not appear to have people from the healthcare industry, you know, around him in a tight-knit way, lobbying hard for health issues. And so maybe that's because he has been perceived up till now as an outsider candidate. Maybe all these interests are not interested in an outsider candidate. Maybe they think it's a waste of their time. Or maybe Brown has no interest in these types of advisors and has turned them away or has not sought their advice. But any way you cut it, he does not seem to have them.
There's a real chicken and egg question that comes up in interpreting the information you found about who is advising the presidential candidates. The question is, did the candidates attract these advisors because of the candidates' positions, or have these advisors directly influenced the thinking of the candidates?
Right. No, and we mentioned that in our study, and I know it seems like a cop-out, but because it's a chicken and egg problem, and unless you have extensive interviews with the candidate himself, hours and hours of interviews, and with each of these advisors, a much more in-depth look than we attempted, you couldn't begin to try to answer that question, really, I don't think, fairly.
Does it make a difference to you if an advisor is paid or unpaid in trying to measure the influence that advisor has on a presidential candidate?
Well, you might find this a little bit interesting or strange, but I personally am most interested in the unpaid advisors. The paid ones, we know where they worked. We know that they had taken a leave of absence or quit their jobs, and we know that they're now working for the campaign. It's all very cut and dried. And it doesn't mean that they don't have contacts and that firm isn't, you know, jumping up and down in excitement because their candidate's the front runner and they might have an in with the White House. I mean, that all is true. But with an unpaid policy advisor, these people did not quit their day job. They are working for, you know, very powerful, in most cases in this town, multi-billion dollar industries and corporations that have very, very specific interests that they hope will come to fruition in this town. And because we don't know exactly who these people are, and if they're not paid, they're not registered at the Federal Election Commission. So there's this sort of shadowy group that no one knows who they are, no one knows who they work for, and no one knows how close they are to the candidate, and their names aren't listed anywhere in this town, those are the ones that are most interesting to me, because they're also the ones no one ever talks about because it's so hard to find out who they are. And that's why we were kind of excited to do this study, because I think it's the first time anyone's ever attempted to systematically list these people.
Many of the aides who you've written about in your report on presidential campaign advisors, many of these aides are lobbyists, and in your report you write that lobbyists have become the Washington equivalent of what investment bankers were to the New Yorker of the 1980s. Let me ask you to extend that analogy.
Well, there is this kind of robust get-while-the-getting's-good feeling in Washington. There has been for about 10 or 15 years now. And you have young people who come in the government now. Well, actually, we have a problem in government. People don't want to come in the government at all. There's a crisis in public service. There's been a commission created, and they've issued their findings. They find that the best and the brightest don't go in the government anymore, and a lot of the best people in government are leaving. And a lot of the people are going instead into the private sector, into this vast, what I call, mercenary culture in Washington. And there are dollar signs in their eyes. They see access to government, access to the White House, making deals as a very exciting thing. And there used to be a time 10, 20, 30 years ago when coming to Washington, what you were going to try to bring about change and you know, make things better for your country and for the people of this nation and all that. And there's all this idealism, and that's not the way anymore. And you have certain perversions and commercialization of public service where if you are a former this or a former that, you can get more money in the marketplace. There's a marketplace mentality for credentials and resume-type items for people who were in government. So you have a Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, or former Secretary of State Alexander Haig doing airline commercials. Or you have a former president of the United States, Ronald Reagan, going to Tokyo and giving two 20-minute speeches to Fuji Sankai Communications for $2 million. You wouldn't have seen former Secretary of State Dean Acheson do that in the late 40s. You wouldn't have seen Dwight Eisenhower do that as president in the 50s. There's something really substantially different about this town and how it views government and public service. And those are at the core issues why we created the center. We want to keep looking at these issues and understanding them and probing them and exploring them and seeing where this is all leading. But the first step is to tell people what's happening. And because most people have a cynical view of Washington, but they don't really know how bad it is, I'm afraid. At least I feel that way sometimes.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Lewis is the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. The center's latest report is Under the Influence, Presidential Candidates and Their Campaign Advisors. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. On today's program, we follow up on yesterday's results from the Georgia primary, hearing from NPR's David Mulpis, who covered that race, and our own Linda Wertheimer, who's been traveling through the South. They talk about the results from Georgia and what they foretell about next week's Southern primaries on Super Tuesday. Also, news of another kind of competition, the selection of this year's Calypso Monarch at Carnival in Trinidad. The winner was none other than the Mighty Sparrow, who had won it so many times that he retired from the competition more than a dozen years ago. Those stories and the news coming up today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
After three hit Indiana Jones movies, producer George Lucas is bringing his character to TV in a new series that features not one Indy, but three. TV critic David Bianculli explains.
You remember the last Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? That was the one where River Phoenix played a teenaged Indiana Jones in a flashback before Harrison Ford showed up. Well, the structure of the new ABC series, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, takes that time-shifting technique and pushes it even further. Some episodes in the Chronicles will focus on Indy as a young man, at age 16. Other episodes will show him at age 10. In all cases, the stories will be told by a modern-day Indy who's now 93 years old and counting. And in this week's premiere, viewers get to meet all three in a two-hour adventure that begins in Egypt, ends in Mexico, and features such supporting characters as Lawrence of Arabia, George S. Patton, and Pancho Villa. The various Indies are played by relative unknowns. Corey Carrier is the boy version, Sean Patrick Flannery is the young man, and George Hall plays the old codger, who in the premiere sees a couple of bored kids in a museum and holds them spellbound with his stories of mummies, bandits, and faraway places.
So what about the jackal?
The jackal? What jackal?
The one with the eyes of fire. Did it ever turn up?
Yes. Jackal with the eyes of fire. Well, that's another story.
Oh, come on, mister. We gotta know what happened.
Oh, what did you?
Hey, man, we gotta. Come on, mister, please.
That's the reaction George Lucas wants from all the youngsters watching Young Indiana Jones. The plan is to get them interested, maybe even excited, about foreign lands, foreign languages, historical figures, existential questions, the whole Joseph Campbell ball of wax. The objective is terrific, the scenery is gorgeous, and there's no denying the thrill in watching a 10-year-old kid climb up one of the Great Pyramids. With 98% of all TV shows filmed in either California or Canada, that's a big treat. But to some adults, the parade of historical figures may seem a little too gimmicky, and the dialogue a little too obvious. Here's a scene where 10-year-old Indy and his tutor, played by Margaret Tysak, get an impromptu lecture from Lawrence of Arabia. Joseph Bennett plays T.E. Lawrence, Ned, to friends like little Indy.
You are breathing the same air as the men who laid the mummy to rest.
Wow. Sounds great. I'd like to be an archaeologist.
Maybe you'll add a new page to history, or discover a treasure beyond price.
And get rich.
No, Henry. The archaeologists don't get rich. Archaeology doesn't steal from the past. It opens it, so that everyone may learn from its treasures.
On the one hand, I think that's a little overwritten. On the other hand, it seems hypocritical of me to keep moaning about what a dumb and boring and bland TV season this is, then turn around and complain about minor flaws in a program this different, this well-meaning, and this ambitious. Hey, it even has subtitles for the foreign language portions, instead of having everyone everywhere speak English like the series The Time Tunnel did. But if I had a third hand, I'd point out that I was wrong in guessing that my own kids would find the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles slow and wordy and dull. They were as captivated as those kids listening to the old Indy, and they loved it. So while adults may look at this series with a jaded eye, children will be wide-eyed and really might learn something. There's not as much action as in the Indiana Jones movies, but in this series, it's not the action that counts. It's the reaction of the youngsters who tune in.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise and fall of BCCI. Los Angeles Times reporter Douglas Franz has just co-authored a new book about the world's most crooked bank. Franz also recently investigated how George Bush aided Saddam Hussein before the Gulf War. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.